We are absolutely delighted to have Jeremy Hunt, one of the most distinguished ministers, politicians, parliamentarians, thinkers, writers, indeed, of the last 25 years, talking to us today. And thank you, Jeremy, very much indeed.
Absolute pleasure to be here, Anthony.
Oh, my goodness. So many things that we could talk about. But let's perhaps pick up on the very well-received book published earlier this year, Can We Be Great Again? And tell us about that, because we need it, some optimism and hope in the slightly gloomy politics and economic environment we're in at the moment. Jeremy, what was the book about? Why did you write it? And how hopeful are you?
Well, I wrote it. It's the book I wish I'd been given on the day I became Foreign Secretary. Because when you become Foreign Secretary, you're shown into this wonderful office that you know very well, having written the definitive book about it. And it knocks you sideways because it's about three times bigger than the Prime Minister's office. It's far grander. It's, you know, got beautiful oak paneling. It's got, you know, bookshelves, wonderful paintings. And every Foreign Secretary, including Yvette Cooper when she became Foreign Secretary a couple of months ago, we all have exactly the same thought the first moment we go into that office as a new Foreign Secretary. And the thought is this: is this just an imperial delusion? Are we kidding ourselves that we are a great country? Or is there something to it? And I thought, I'm going to write a book and get to the bottom of it. And my conclusion is absolutely that we are a great country and we can continue to be great. But I looked at the evidence from around the world and I looked at all the big issues the world faces, whether it's climate change or security in Europe or the future of democracy or free trade or the migration crisis.
And I said,
aging population, what do the independent experts say about Britain's clout in solving these problems? And in every single case, they said that of the 193 countries in the United Nations, we are in the top 10 most influential. We're often in the top five most influential. And what I realized is there is this incredible mismatch between how we view ourselves, which, as you say, is all doom and gloom, and how other people see us. And when it comes to young people, it's an even bigger mismatch, because there was a survey quite recently that said that a third of young people would like to move abroad. And two-thirds think our country is in decline. And then around the same time, the British Council did a survey of young people across all the G20 countries, you know, the biggest 20 economies in the world. And they asked them, what do they think about different countries? And the UK was the third most admired country overall, after Italy and Japan. We were the second most trusted when it came to our people. And when it came to the country that is the biggest force for good in the world, we came top. So that's how young people in other countries see us. At the same time as, you know, sadly here, many young people are feeling very depressed.
So let's have a go at unpacking that. Now, when you went into that Foreign Secretary's office for the first time as Foreign Secretary in the building that Palmerston, the great British Foreign Secretary and Prime Minister in the 1860s, he oversaw that building, Britain was indeed, Jeremy, not just the most admired, maybe, but the most powerful country on earth. And the last 170, 80 years have seen a slow dwindling of Britain's political and economic power, undeniably. But what is it that does make us still, make Britain still such a powerful force in the world, a small island off continental Europe, glory days of economic, military, and political power behind us, empire in decline. What is it? What are the factors? Does the monarchy play a part? Is it the English language? What is it, Jeremy?
Well, all of those things. But, you know, if you look, I've been trying to dig out some figures as to how many people across the world looked at the funeral of Her Majesty the Queen. And I think it's getting on for 2 billion people, which is potentially a quarter of the world's population. 20% of the world speaks English as a language they can communicate in, even if it's not their first language. And you mentioned history. I think it's interesting because our history undeniably shapes the way people view us. And we didn't get everything right in our history by any means at all. And you will know this as a historian more than me. But we were not just the biggest empire in the history of mankind, but also one of the only ones that disbanded itself voluntarily and not entirely peacefully, but as peacefully as we possibly could. And people do remember that. And most importantly, in terms of recent history, they remember that after the Second World War, Britain and the United States between them set up an international order that, for all the problems we face as human beings, has been the most successful in the history of mankind. It's led to more prosperity, more freedom, more trade than ever in history. And, you know, basically it was a period in history in which human beings, compared to the past, fought each other less and traded with each other more. And just as one example, when I was born in 1966, half the world was in extreme poverty, defined as an income of less than a dollar a day. Now it's less than $2 a day because of inflation. Now it's less than 10% of the world in extreme poverty, even though the global population has increased nearly threefold over that period. So people are really worried now because the world has become so much more dangerous in the last 5 years. And there is, you know, so many threats on many different fronts. And they're looking at Britain and they're looking at America and they're saying, look, you created something that for all its faults worked pretty well. Are you going to step up to the plate now and help us protect what was good? Even if we want to change and we recognize the need for change, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's why people want Britain to play more of a leadership role internationally. And you can't say that about very many countries.
So, reasons why Britain can and should be optimistic. What accounts for the defeatism? I mean, so many people want to be republicanism on the rise, support for the monarchy on the decline, depending which poll one looks at. And national institutions like the BBC appear and the civil service appear to be incapable of reforming themselves. One of the features of nations in decline, whether Spain in the 16th century or France in the 17th century, is a turning in and a cynicism. Any thoughts on that and how to combat it, Jeremy?
Well, there are elements of that, I'm afraid, and we can see that. And I don't think it's borne out by the reality, because I think we just forget that other countries have their problems too. But I think that if you take that theory, which I do subscribe to, that in history, you know, empires that are rising have tended to be the most open to the brightest and best ideas from around the world and adopt them. You know, the way the Roman army adopted the ideas and armies that it conquered, if they saw a good idea, they nicked it. And I would say that the interesting thing about the global situation we're in now is that the power that most often is talked about as the rising power is also closing up compared to where it was 10 years ago. China is a much more closed society. If they had stayed on the path they were in 2012, sort of heading towards being a kind of giant Singapore, we'd probably all be moving to China, but we're not. And, you know, we have a global migration crisis, partly because of the positive reason that people can afford to move in a way they couldn't afford to do, you know, when Bob Geldof was doing, you know, Live Aid in Ethiopia.
In 85.
And where do they want to move to? They don't want to move to Russia. They don't want to move to China. They want to go to Europe, North America, Australia, Japan, countries that treat their own citizens humanely and well. So we've got lots of very profound problems. And I think the reason, to answer your original question as to why people are gloomy, is because we've had a rotten period. We had a global financial crisis, a once-in-a-century pandemic, an energy shock. We've had much lower economic growth than we used to. And that has made people feel pretty gloomy. And by the way, our politicians have made lots of mistakes along the way. And I hold my hand up as someone who's been in some of the governments that haven't got everything right. But, you know, my argument in this book, it's not a jingoistic book. I'm not saying that Britain is better than other countries, although I'm very proud to be British. But I make the same argument to an audience of Australians or French or Germans or Japanese. My argument is, in such a dangerous world, the worst thing you can do is underestimate your own ability to try and sort out problems. This is the time for all of us who believe in democratic values and open societies to roll up our sleeves and try and sort out some of these big issues.
Looking at one of the big issues, which is Britain's financial state, and there are questions from Akwasi, there are questions from Lauren and Leila around the question of the size of the debt that Britain has got itself into, Jeremy. I mean, what happened? Why is Britain so much in debt that makes the freedom for governments so narrow? How did that happen? Did it have to happen? But also, why was the money not more productively spent on improving the public services, improving the roads, the water system, the prisons, the hospitals, the schools, preparing for AI? Can you just take us through the national debt and how that happened and what can now happen to address it? Of course, so, Chancellor between 2022 and following Kwasi Kwarteng's unhappy budget in September 2022. So you were there at the heart of it for 2 years.
So I'm going to answer that question in two parts. The first is, what has happened? And the second is, what do we do to solve the problem? And it's absolutely right that we ask this question because, you know, our national debt has now risen to just under 100% of GDP. That means that the average household in the UK is paying just under £4,000 a year in tax just to pay our debt interest. So in our tax bill, we pay more for our debt interest than the cost of our education system, the cost of our police, the cost of our armed forces. And it's happened because we had a series of big financial shocks, the global financial crisis when we had to bail out the banks, we've had the COVID where we spent £350 billion keeping families and businesses afloat during the pandemic. We had the energy shock where I had to allocate nearly £100 billion to help families when fuel bills soared following the invasion of Ukraine. But over that period, we have not had very strong economic growth. So normally what happens is that, you know, debt might go up in cash terms, but because you're growing healthily as a proportion of your GDP, it's not going up, but that has not happened. And our debt's gone up from about a third of GDP to 95% of GDP at the moment. And it's not just us. It's happened across developed countries, you know, and countries like France and Italy and Japan and America. They actually have higher debt as a proportion of GDP than we have. But the truth is, it's got to stop because of two reasons. Firstly, It's now costing the government over £100 billion a year. It's making budgets a nightmare because all this money that you used to be able to spend on you know, the NHS and schools, you're now having to pay to people as interest for the money they've lent us. And that is a nightmare for chancellors. But also that money that you spend on debt interest doesn't help to grow the economy. It's not being invested in nuclear power stations. It's paying, a lot of it is paying foreigners for lending money. So that's the one reason. The second reason is just a moral one. Why should we be giving our kids this enormous burden of debt? I mean, mine are 11, 13, 15, and I don't think they thought too much about our national debt. But as soon as they start work, they are going to be paying taxes that are much higher because of that debt. And I think that's wrong. My parents, your parents, Anthony, they didn't bequeath us those kind of debt levels. And I don't think we should be bequeathing them to future generations if we want them to have better lives than we've had. So that's the problem. And what's the solution? Well, the solution, I think, is a very straightforward one. You can't eliminate debt overnight. But you can
and just explain why you can't write it off.
If you wrote it off in the way that countries like, you know, Argentina have done in the past, if you do that, then people won't lend you money again in the future. And it's as simple as that. And, you know, Britain must be a country that pays its way in the world and pays its debts. And that's a fundamental importance, I think. So you can't write it off. But what you can do is do something gentler, but more significant over a longer period of time. And that is to say that we will never allow our debt to grow faster than the economy. We'll never increase our public spending by more than we're growing. And I think, you know, Rachel Reeves talks about fiscal rules. I have fiscal rules. Neither of us actually had the fiscal rule that really matters, that says that over a parliament, we will not increase our public spending by more than the economy is growing. And that is the fiscal rule we need to have. I think it's completely fair. It would mean more discipline on public spending, but not in a dangerous way that caused economic contraction, in a sensible way that allowed us to gradually bring down the burden of debt and therefore allow businesses to invest and expand, which they're finding so hard at the moment.
One has to mention that even that idea would suppose there wasn't going to be another pandemic, which is it is more sadly than as a small possibility, or that there isn't another energy price rise because of something that Russia or something else has gone wrong. Britain is in such a precarious position. When was Britain last in such a precarious financial position, Jeremy?
Second World War. And you're absolutely right, because what's happened in the past is that every time we've had a shock in the good times, we've then brought down our debt. But what happened in the last 15 years, and I don't actually blame the people in charge at the time, because, you know, George Osborne cut public spending by 19% in 2010. That was far bigger than Margaret Thatcher ever managed. So he made pretty valiant effort. He got the deficit right down from 10% to 3% of GDP. So, but the issue is that these shocks came one after the other. So we were just getting the deficit under control after the financial crisis when we had the pandemic, and then we had the energy shock. And it's that happening of these shocks in close succession which has made it difficult to bring the debt down again, which is what we've done for so many years, over centuries.
So a vulnerable position. Give us growth is the best hope. Give us four ideas from your forthcoming book on growth that you would like to see implemented by the Labour government that we now have in the very near future?
Well, very straightforward. I mean, I think there are some things that are staring us in the face. So if we tackled our welfare crisis, which means that at the moment we are signing off 2,200 adults every single day, and we're saying you don't have to work, you don't even have to look for work, we're parking you on welfare. And most of the time they stay there. If we tackle that, we have about three quarters of our adults in work. And in Switzerland and Denmark and countries like that, they're not 75%, they're 80%. So they get an extra 5% of the workforce into work. That has a dramatic impact on GDP. It actually increases your GDP by 5% if you talk to economists, all other things being equal. And of course, it means a much lower bill for the chancellor when it comes to benefits. That means lower taxes. That means, again, more growth. And that's one of the reasons why places like the Netherlands and Switzerland and Denmark are more prosperous than we are. So that's one. A second one would be to, you know, the state is 20% of our economy. And about half of that is actually the NHS, just under half. So if you improved NHS productivity, which is something that I did as Health Secretary and Chancellor, and actually, in fairness, the government says it's committed to, but you could actually directly increase our GDP if you improve, if NHS productivity was 2% a year, which is the long-term private sector rate, that itself adds 0.2, 0.3% to annual GDP growth. So that'd be another one. And then a third one is a very straightforward one. You know, we have the highest energy prices of any major country. If we got those down by about 20%, the OECD say it would add 0.3% to annual GDP growth. Now, 0.3% might sound a small number, but we're only growing at 1% or so, and compounded up year after year, that makes a very big difference. So there are some straightforward things we could do. I'm afraid we didn't hear very many of them in the recent budget, which is a great shame. But you know, but we mustn't give up because, you know, Labour are going to be in power probably until 2029, and we really do need them to embrace these things.
And Luca Templeman there was just wanting to know that very question about why on earth don't successive governments get on and do welfare reform. Let's look at the political response. And there's a lot of obviously interest in the Conservatives and a direct question about what would have happened if you had won the last election and if you'd beaten Boris Johnson and become prime minister yourself. How would you have handled things differently?
Well, first of all, there are areas where I think the last government or the 14 years of Conservative administrations got wrong. And energy policy is one of them. We were very good on climate change. We decarbonized by more than any other large economy, but we paid for it with the highest electricity bills in anywhere in Europe, four times more than America. And I think that we need to recognize that cheap energy is a very, very important element of economic growth. But on welfare reform, I actually do defend the record because Ian Duncan Smith did incredibly bold changes to welfare. He abolished or he merged five benefits into universal credit. There was a dramatic drop in the number of families where no one was working, a million fewer children growing up in workless households. Things started to go badly wrong in the pandemic. But Mel Stride and I also introduced some big welfare reforms in my autumn statement of 2023. Just remind me, Anthony, your question was, what would have been different if I had won against Boris? Obviously, it's very difficult to answer these questions objectively, but in a nutshell, I think that the thing that Boris did and might have done better than me was sort out the mess we were in over Brexit, because he got us out. He got a deal with the EU. It was messy around the edges. There were bits that had to be sorted out subsequently by Rishi Sunak when it came to Northern Ireland, and Keir Starmer's trying to sort out a few more things as well. But the truth is that he has seen me as more reasonable than Boris, and therefore they might not have offered me the deal that they offered Boris. And, you know, they thought Boris was just mad enough to do a no-deal Brexit. And so in the end, because they didn't want that, they came to the table with a deal. And I would have gone for exactly the same kind of thing, but I think it would have been tougher. However, I think I would have probably been a better prime minister than Boris in the pandemic, having been health secretary for nearly 6 years and knowing a lot of these issues. And I think our biggest mistake in the pandemic, if we had adopted the system they had in Taiwan and Korea, where you quarantine people who get the virus really quickly and you really quickly chase up everyone they've been in contact with, both those two places avoided lockdowns at all in the first year. I mean, restaurants and shops all stayed open in Taiwan and Korea for the whole of the first year of COVID. And we could have avoided some of the very negative consequences. So it's easy to say this with the benefit of hindsight, but that's probably what I think the difference would have been.
Questions about the Conservative Party, about how can it regain trust, public trust? Is it ever going to win a majority again?
Well, I think you will. I think it's a very unrealistic to expect a party to recover immediately after it's had its worst ever defeat in its history. And so, you know, I don't think anyone would have done better than Kemi Badenoch as leader in the last year. And I think it's going to take time. But the truth is that as this parliament goes on, people are worrying more and more about the economy under Labour, because they know that's the heart of all the issues we face. And I think if the Conservative Party is the sensible party that offers credible solutions on the economy, then we will be back in the race. And I think that, you know, for all the things we may have got wrong in the 14 years we were in office, we did do the one thing that people want from a Conservative government or Conservative governments, which is to take tough and difficult decisions to get the economy back on its feet in a crisis. And I think people sort of know that. So I think that there is definitely a path back for us.
They're from Milana and from Aidan. And Leo and Rupert are asking Jeremy whether reform is going to be an existential threat to the Conservative Party. Looking at the polling today, it would certainly suggest that Leo and Rupert are asking a very fair question.
I think you asked that in a five-party system, as we're now in England, in Scotland and Wales, it's a six-party system with the Nationalist parties, the Greens, the Lib Dems, Reform, and Labour and the Conservatives. With first past the post, you only need 30% of the vote to win, and Reform on 30% of the vote in the national polls. So that it is possible, if the polls are like they are today, in 2029. And that's the point, isn't it, really? It's a long way off this next election. And I don't think Labour is going to call it before they have to, because they're in such a mess. And I think the issue with reform is ultimately economic credibility. Do people trust them to take difficult decisions? I mean, you know, in the last few months, you know, Nigel Farage has been saying that he wants to reopen the coal mines in South Wales, nationalise the water industry, hundreds of billions of pounds, slash taxes by raising the allowance before you pay any tax. None of it adds up. And I think that is the weakness in the reform offering. And as I say, as we get closer to an election, I think people will start to realise that actually a strong economy is the foundation of everything. And that's where the Conservatives do have credibility.
What about looking at the left, as Raf and Alex have done, and looking at tactical voting, Jeremy? Do you think that anti-reform tactical voting could result in a Labour-Green coalition in 2029?
That's obviously what Keir Starmer's hoping. And he's, in one way, he's right, because the left, the centre-left in British politics, have been practising tactical voting for the last seven elections. So if you're a centre-left voter, you sort of know in Brighton to vote Green, in Wales to vote Plaid, in Godalming and Ash to vote Lib Dem, in a red wall seat to vote Labour. whereas the centre-right has never done any tactical voting. We've always, you know, it's always been conservative until now with reform. So, you know, Keir Starmer's hoping to win the election in the way that Macron did in France. But I think that...
Unpack that for those not so familiar.
So in the presidential election in France last time round, the final two candidates were President Macron and Marine Le Pen. And basically Macron said, I'm calling on the whole of France to unite to stop this fascist Marine Le Pen being elected. And he got elected. It hasn't worked out very well for him since then, it has to be said. But I think that's what Keir Starmer is going to try and say with Nigel Farage. You've got to vote for us to keep Farage out. But I would say this, if a country wants to remove an incompetent government, they will find a way to do it. And I think Keir Starmer should not take false comfort. He's forgetting that by the time we get to the next election, people will be looking at Labour's record. They'll be looking at the fact that taxes have gone up on working people, despite the fact Labour promised not to raise taxes on working people. They'll be looking at the fact that the economy hasn't grown, despite Labour saying growth was its number one priority. And I think the fundamental problem for Labour at the next election, even with the advantages they may get from tactical voting, is an innate fear that people have that you can't trust Labour governments with your money. And far from dispelling that, which Tony Blair and Gordon Brown went to enormous lengths in the new Labour years, and particularly in the budgets, to make sure people felt that you can trust this lot with our money and our jobs and our future and our economic security. It feels to me like Labour have done the exact opposite of that. And that is something that people will, I think, find hard to forgive.
In your political career, Jeremy, another question, have you seen a weaker Labour Prime Minister and Chancellor? And Lauren and Leila are asking whether Rachel Reeves can survive, and indeed, if she goes, whether the Prime Minister would have to go also, as indeed Liz Truss quickly followed the departure of Kwasi Kwarteng.
I think their fates are inextricably linked. I think, you know, you have to ask yourself, what would Keir Starmer feel like the morning after Rachel Reeves resigned, even after an unpopular budget? I think he would look very vulnerable indeed. And I think he's calculated that, which is why he's rowing in behind Rachel Reeves, even after the problems associated with the budget. And although I think the budget was extremely disappointing, we probably should be careful what we wish for, because I don't think, you know, Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves, if they left Downing Street, would be replaced by someone more centrist than them. I think they would be replaced by a Prime Minister and Chancellor who are more left-wing than them, not least because the electorate will be the Labour Party. It won't be the country. And the Labour Party are going to choose someone more Labour, if you like. And so that's why I think it is a moment of peril for the country if there is instability at the top of the Labour Party.
So how would that happen if indeed there was a more Labour PM and a more left-wing Labour MP, PM and a more left-wing Labour Chancellor? Would the markets at that stage lose confidence? When in recent history would that be like? Would that be like Black Wednesday or the IMF crisis in 76?
Well, you know, I think that's the reality that no one or many people in the Labour Party don't quite understand that, you know, all these, this comment that Andy Burnham said about us not being in, we shouldn't be in hock to the bond markets. The reality is that we have a choice. You know, we are borrowing a lot of money in the markets every single month because we have a very large deficit. And you know, if we start making suggestions that we're not going to bother about keeping our borrowing under control, they will either stop lending to us or they'll certainly put up the price of that debt, which will make our fiscal problems even worse than those faced by Rachel Reeves in the budget.
At that point, there has to be a general election if indeed we can't retain the confidence of Parliament. It gets back to the question, Jeremy, about whether there's a systemic problem in Britain with the Prime Minister and with our political parties managing the financial debt position that it's in and managing expectations of voters and indeed their own members and MPs. And it's not unique, as you said earlier.
No, it's not unique. I don't think there is a systemic problem because, you know, I think back to Geoffrey Howe and Margaret Thatcher in 1979. I think back to Alistair Darling in the global financial crisis. They took some very big decisions in a pretty bad crisis. I think to George Osborne and David Cameron in 2010, I think about the decisions I had to take with Rishi Sunak in 2022. And I think we are perfectly capable of taking difficult decisions in difficult economic circumstances, but we just need our current leaders to get their mojo back and to actually start tackling these problems, like, you know, the explosion in welfare recipients. And then we can start getting back the growth that we would all want.
Absolutely. Now, and who would not want that to happen, but who also isn't concerned that that might not happen? What might have happened, Jeremy, if you had not taken over as Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain following the mini budget in early October 2022 and steadied the ship? What's the worst that might have happened had you kept all the measures in place, for example?
Well, I think that you know, we were worried, you know, we could have a currency collapse, a stock market collapse.
Tell us about that. What does a currency collapse and a stock market collapse entail?
Because, you know, the thing about the UK is that, and it's a both advantage, but we are one of the most open and most internationalized economies in the world. We've really flourished in that over many centuries. You know, London is one of the world's greatest cities, if not the greatest city in the world, because it's welcomed the brilliant, bright, motivated people from all over the world to come and make their fame and fortune here. And that's a great strength. But it also means that when things go wrong, people can disappear very quickly. And that's always the risk you have. Also, because the whole world speaks English, which is what we've been talking about, we are the global leader at washing our dirty linen in public. When things go wrong in a British budget, they know about it in Singapore and Tokyo and Los Angeles and probably in Fiji. So, you know, that's why you have to be very careful to maintain the confidence of international markets. I think much more careful than you have in a less globalized economy, like, say, France's economy or I don't know, Austria's economy or other countries which haven't opened themselves up as much as we have, which I think, as I say, has generally been a very big advantage.
And just two questions to close that, types of questions from students. And Imi Routledge says, good question. I mean, why are MPs not paid more so that we can have a better quality of MPs and ultimately ministers and ultimately prime ministers? And Sissy Brown says, totally differently, how would you deal with abuse on social media? Have you suffered from it? And are we too liberal on social media?
It's a very hard one. I mean, MPs are paid £93,000, which is, you know, quite a lot compared to the average salary of £37,000. And, you know, generally speaking, because Conservative MPs tend to come from a business background, Often we take a pay cut when we become an MP, and Labour MPs who perhaps come from a social justice campaigning educational background, it's often a pay rise for them. And so I think it's a difficult one. Would we get better quality candidates if MPs' pay was higher? I'm a little bit sceptical about that. I think politics is a vocation, and in the end, it needs to attract people. I think the thing that puts people off going to politics is actually the public criticism that you get, which is the second question that you asked. And my answer to that is twofold. First of all, I always say that the only criticism I ever care about is from someone who knows me. Because most of that criticism on social media is people who don't like my blue rosette. I've had loads of it, by the way. In 2016, I was the most unpopular politician in the country because of the junior doctors' strike. And, you know, and I've had plenty of abuse, but I always sort of think, well, actually, what they don't like is the Conservatives. They don't know me. Now, not trying to put you under any pressure here, Anthony, but if you criticize me publicly, that would matter to me because we know each other very well of old and we're great friends. But I don't worry if it's some random person on the internet because that's just politics. And, you know, and I most of the time I don't look at those comments anyway. But what I would say to, you know, people at Wellington is don't be put off by that public criticism of politics. Actually, we should be very proud to be in a country where we can say what we like about our leaders. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. And there is no job that has more dignity and more value than public service. You are making decisions that affect everyone, and it's an incredible thing to do. And I think I don't regret a second of my time, and I've had lots of ups and downs. And I think that in the end, public service is a huge privilege, and I will never really be able to find happiness doing anything else having done it. And that's not to say I didn't have a wonderful time when I was setting up and running my own business, but it is a real privilege to be able to wrestle with the big issues that define the future of our country and the future of humanity.
Well, that's a very inspiring note to finish on, really, that careers and rewards in life are more than purely financial, and that happiness and a sense of personal worth and satisfaction and meaning can come from trying to do good for others and to others, and public service. Certainly, I would endorse that totally, Jeremy. And if a country doesn't have top policy people coming into it, politics and into public life and into the police and into the military and into the civil service and beyond, then that country will truly be in decline. And we are finishing. We've finished on a very optimistic note that you started on about things might be not look so rosy in Britain at the moment. And there are sane reasons for thinking that. But actually, people abroad see Britain in a very different way. And there are very good reasons for thinking that Britain's going to come through this period on top and leading the world as a shining example of a good nation that you talk about in that book and that you will be talking about in your book on growth. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony.